ప్రతిరుద్రేంద్రియ ప్రాణ మనోబుద్ధిం ఉపారతం స్థానత్రయాత్ పరం ప్రాప్తం బ్రహ్మభూతం అవిక్రియం ప్రతిరుద్రేంద్రియ ప్రాణ మనోబుద్ధిం ఉపారతం స్థానత్రయాత్ పరం ప్రాప్తం బ్రహ్మభూతం అవిక్రియం ప్రతిరుద్రేంద్రియ ప్రాణ మనోబుద్ధిం ఉపారతం స్థానత్రయాత్ పరం ప్రాప్తం బ్రహ్మభూతం అవిక్రియం ప్రతిరూఢ రిస్ట్రెయిన్డ్ ఇంద్రియ ద సెన్స్ ఆర్గన్స్ ప్రాణ ఎయిర్ ఆఫ్ రెస్పిరేషన్ మనః ద మైండ్ బుద్ధిం ఇంటెలిజెన్స్ ఉపారతం ఇనాక్టివ్ స్థాన ప్లేసెస్ త్రయాత్ ఫ్రమ్ ద త్రీ పరం ట్రాన్సెండెంటల్ ప్రాప్తం అచీవ్డ్ బ్రహ్మభూతం క్వాలిటేటివ్లీ ఈక్వల్ విత్ ద సుప్రీం అబ్సల్యూట్ అవిక్రియం అన్ఎఫెక్టెడ్ ట్రాన్స్లేషన్ ద మునీస్ సెన్స్ ఆర్గన్స్ బ్రెత్ మైండ్ అండ్ ఇంటెలిజెన్స్ వేర్ ఆల్ రిస్ట్రెయిన్డ్ ఫ్రమ్ మటీరియల్ యాక్టివిటీస్ అండ్ హీ వాజ్ సిట్యుయేటెడ్ ఇన్ అ ట్రాన్స్ Apart from the three, wakefulness, dream and unconsciousness, having achieved a transcendental position, qualitatively equal with the Supreme Absolute. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. It appears that the Muni, in whose hermitage the king entered, was in a yogic trance. The transcendental position is attained by three processes, namely, the process of jnana, or theoretical knowledge of the transcendence, the process of yoga, or factual realization of trance by manipulation of physiological and psychological functions of the body, and the most approved process of bhakti yoga, or the engagement of senses in the devotional service of the Lord. In the Bhagavad Gita also, we have information of the gradual development of perception from matter to a living entity. Our material mind and body developed from the living entity, the soul, and being influenced by the three qualities of matter, we forget our real identity. The jnana process theoretically speculates about the reality of the soul, but the bhakti yoga factually engages the spirit soul in activities. The perception of matter is transcendental to still subtler states of the senses. The senses are transcended to the subtler mind and then to breathing activities and gradually to the intelligence. Beyond the intelligence, the living soul is realized by the mechanical activities of the yoga system or practice of meditation, restraining the senses, regulating the breathing system, and applying intelligence to rise to the transcendental position. This trance stops all material activities of the body. The king saw the muni in that position. He also saw the muni as follows. Om Agyanti Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutaha Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ragunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Shute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhyayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Ramo Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. In this section of Srimad Bhagavatam, we are seeing a very, very important story of Parikshit Maharaj meeting Shamik Rishi. So the situation is that Parikshit Maharaj is a great king, he's emperor of the world, the great grandson of the Pandavas, and he is on a hunting expedition, gone in the forest, and while he was in the forest, he feels very thirsty at some point. And in search of water, something to drink, he enters into this Rishi's ashram, and Shamik Rishi is, you know, is in a trance. That's what is mentioned here. And seeing Shamik Rishi in a trance, Parikshit Maharaj is asking for water, but Shamik Rishi is completely absorbed in something higher, and he does not give him water. And Parikshit Maharaj is going to retaliate, and the whole story of Bhagavatam unfolds after that. So, let us just first analyze this idea of hunger and thirst first. So, all of us, every day we experience hunger and thirst, isn't it? At particular points in time, the body clock gives us signal that you're hungry, you're thirsty, you know. And you immediately have to go and satisfy that hunger and thirst. Great sages, they have overcome this hunger and thirst. I don't know how many of you all know, there is one sadhu in Gujarat. His name is some Jani, I think his surname is. This man has not eaten or drunk anything for last 75 years. Nothing wanted to do his body. Now you might say, like these electric cars, you charge it and it runs for 250 kilometers, you know. So is there some kind of electric signal that is running him, you know? So these saints, they have reached another level. But we are not at that level. We are like Parikshit Maharaj, who is affected by hunger and thirst. So let us analyze a little bit about hunger and thirst and try to understand the problems associated with hunger and thirst. Human life is never free from any problems. We'll always have some problem or the other. Every day we feel hunger. And if we don't feel hunger, that's also a disease. Isn't it? If you don't feel appetite, if you don't feel hunger, so doctors ask you, right? Are you feeling appetite, you know? If you say, I don't have any hunger. Unless you are a sadhu and a yogi, if you say, I don't have any hunger, that's understandable. If you are a yogi, it's understandable. But if you are a normal person, and you say, I have no hunger, it's a disease. So if you are hungry, then the problem is what to eat. If you have food, then the problem is that food tasty? And is that food hygienic? Is that food, you know, satisfying? Or does it have some food poisoning in it? Or is there any other disease connected with it? So many problems are associated with getting food, isn't it? Now, when you are not hungry, that also is a disease. So if you are hungry, not getting tasty food is a disease. And if you are getting tasty food, then eating too much is a disease. You know, if you eat too much, that also causes illness. That means, whatever you do in this world, there will be some problem or the other. If you are hungry also is a problem. If you are not hungry also is a problem. If you are hungry and eat the wrong food also is a problem. If you are hungry and eat too much of that, of tasty food, that also is a problem. And if you are not hungry also is a problem. So everything is a problem, literally, you know, potentially. The way the body has to function, and the way the body and mind have to function, is in a balanced fashion. That's what the whole idea of yoga is. That's what the whole idea of regulation is. Just like there are three things, kapha, vata and pitta, Ayurveda prescribes. So these kapha, vata, pitta have to be in a balanced fashion for the body to function nicely. Similarly, there are three types of mindsets, or rather three types of moods that regulate the mind. Kama, krodha and lobha. These three have to be regulated. So disturbance or imbalance of these three will also cause disease. But it causes mental disease. Kama is connected with vata. Kapha is connected with lobha. And krodha is connected with pitta. So if you notice, when you get very angry, you know, the whole body gets heated up, you know, it's like very acidic atmosphere, you know. And if you feel very greedy, it's considered to be lobha. Lobha means, it's considered kapha. Kapha bodies are little fluffy type of bodies, basically. So more kapha oriented. So, and kama is connected with vata, because the mind runs, right? Somebody who has a lot of desires, the mind keeps running and running and running. Vata people can't sit in one place. They're like very thin, and they keep running around everywhere, you know. The three need not be eradicated, but they have to be balanced for good health. So in balance, these three, they actually become life-giving. When unbalanced, these three cause death. So the way in which these three, kapha, vata, pitta, have to be regulated, the same way kama, krodha and lobha have to be regulated in our lives. Karma is regulated by kama. And pitta, which causes burning, is compared to krodha. So when you are angry on someone, you have this burning sensation, basically. Krodha is necessary in constructive ways. Like say, for example, you know, fighting against some evil, fighting against somebody who is indisciplined, you have to become angry. Similarly, any kind of material progress comes with lobha only. Like there are many youngsters that I meet nowadays who are into path of spirituality. They start practicing Krishna consciousness, but they don't have any ambition. They don't feel ambitious. So they come and ask me, you know, when we become devotees, should we have ambition? Should we not have ambition? I was just meeting one young boy a few days back, and this boy belongs to a business family. Fabulously rich people, very, very well to do. But no passion, no drive to carry on the business. He says, I am preaching nicely, I am doing so much of preaching. Do I really need to bother about my business and all? So, progress for any kind of unnati, any kind of progress, that comes from lobha only. So if you don't have greed, if you don't have lobha, you don't have ambition, you cannot make progress in your lives. So satisfaction instead of lobha stops progress. On the other hand, when you progress, it leads to more lobha. It leads to, you know, more greed, isn't it? So this is again a problem. Presence leads to a problem, absence leads to a problem. If you have lobha, it's a problem. If you don't have lobha, it's a problem, you know. So what do you do? One can and should have lobha, but one should not have ati lobha. Too much greed, basically. So now what is the line between the two? The line is in thinking and acting. So anytime you have great greed in you, that means the potential of you making great progress is also there. But when that greed becomes too much greed, when lobha becomes ati lobha, you will cross any lines to progress. You will do anything to progress, basically. That becomes dangerous. So, whatever you have to learn to have it in a balanced fashion. That is what the whole process of yoga is. So, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Gajendra was caught by a crocodile. That crocodile represents lobha. Many people are caught in the jaws of greed. And the jaws of greed devour a person. Or sometimes people are caught in krodha, anger, like Hiranyakashipu. He was so angry that he was ready to kill his own son. Imagine what kind of anger this is. That ready to destroy his own son. And then the scriptures talk about the karma of Dushasan. So obsessed with, you know, karma. So basically, the Lord incarnates to destroy all the three. He incarnated as Narasingha to destroy Hiranyakashipu. He incarnated to destroy that crocodile with a Sudarshan Chakra. And then he also incarnated to destroy Dushasan through empowering Bhima, basically. So, if lobha becomes excess in, you know, instead of progressing, we can actually go down. So, how to avoid getting into excess lobha, excess greed? The only way is to pray. You can't say that you don't want wealth. Nobody in this world can say you don't want wealth. The only time you will say I don't want wealth is when you are on the deathbed. Naturally, what is the use of you getting wealth after that, isn't it? So, the way to avoid becoming attached to lobha or ati lobha is to pray to the Lord. So, it's not that we don't want wealth. Wealth, gaining wealth means labha. Yeah, there are two words in Sanskrit, you know. Labha and lobha. Labha means gaining and lobha means greed. So, labha should not increase lobha. So that means you should gain wealth, but that gaining of wealth shouldn't become greed. So when you practice spiritual life, when you practice bhakti, it's not that you are against labha. It's not that you are against gaining wealth. But you are against gaining wealth that increases lobha. Or rather, you are against the means of gaining wealth that increases your greed, basically. So many people are under the impression that good people should not be after money. But that's actually nowhere in the scriptures it is written like that, that good people should not have money. Nowhere in the scriptures it is written that good people should not be ambitious. Nowhere in the scriptures it is written that good people should not prosper. Nowhere it is written. In fact, in the Mahabharata, Arjun and Yudhishthira are having a conversation. After the war gets over, Yudhishthira is in a depressed state. He just wants to give up all his wealth and he just wants to go into the forest because he feels responsible for the death of so many thousands of people just for him to get rich. At that point, Arjun makes a very interesting statement. Arjun says that only from a mountain of wealth good can be done. So if you want to do charity, if you want to do any good in this world, you first have to have wealth to do good, isn't it? Nobody can do good unless and until they have sufficient wealth. So Arjun says, from a mountain of wealth can good activities be carried out. So that means for us to do any kind of good to the world, we first need to have enough resources. And that's when you can. So if good people have a lot of resources, then they can do a lot more good. If bad people have a lot of resources, then they can do a lot more bad, isn't it? And therefore, we don't find that only places that are auspicious are prosperous. Even places that are inauspicious also prosper. Like for example, you find in the Ramayana, we find Ayodhya is prosperous. We find Lanka is even more prosperous. It's not that Lanka is less prosperous than Ayodhya, isn't it? So, prosperity is everywhere. But the difference is, in Ayodhya, when you get labha, you also feel satisfied. I've got, I'm happy. In Lanka, if you get labha, you feel lobha, I want more. There is no satisfaction there. And therefore, the scriptures are not against gaining. They are against gaining that doesn't give you satisfaction. They are against taking that doesn't give you satisfaction. It's like endless, basically. Kama and Krodha both have limits. But Lobha is unlimited. There is no limit to Lobha. Kama reduces with age. And Krodha reduces at some point with time. Like, can you remain angry forever? You remain angry for some time and then the anger goes down, isn't it? Nobody can be angry for like 5 hours at a time. You can be angry for like half an hour, 1 hour, you know. After that, your anger decreases. But Lobha increases with time. It grows and grows and grows. Suppose somebody has 1 crore. You think that person is happy with it? They want 2 crores. They want 3 crores. It goes on and on and on. There is no end to the number, basically. And therefore, many times when we have something, when we don't feel satisfaction in that thing, that very thing becomes bad. Good qualities or guna is wonderful. Having good qualities is wonderful. But the same good quality, when it becomes too much, it becomes a dosha. Having too much guna of a particular type, it actually leads to dosha. So having labha, that means gaining wealth, is a good quality, isn't it? But when that crosses a particular limit, that itself becomes a dosha. So therefore, one should learn to be satisfied. Not only with your hunger, but you also should learn to satisfy other people's hunger. So here in this particular verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find there is one hungry, thirsty person who is asking another person who has given up hunger and thirst, please give me some water. And the person who is, you know, given up hunger and thirst, he is in a transcendental world. He is not bothered about hunger and thirst. He is thinking, I have conquered hunger and thirst. Everybody else around me also should have conquered hunger and thirst. But that's not how all the world works, isn't it? You have to conquer your hunger and thirst, but you also have to help others conquer their hunger and thirst. That is the whole idea of what scriptures are trying to say. So the acharyas, they speak about a very interesting concept here. You know, you find this similar story in Gajendra, this elephant. Before his, in his previous life, he was King Indradumna. And when King Indradumna was doing meditation, King Indradumna had a very powerful tapasya. Every day he would do intense tapasya. One day, while he was doing intense tapasya, Agastya Rishi comes to his place. And Agastya Rishi is a powerful sage, isn't it? Agastya comes to his place and this Indradhanu Maharaj continues doing tapasya. Agastya becomes very disturbed and Agastya curses him. He says, "You are so insensitive and indifferent to my presence. I curse you that you will become an elephant." Now, if you look at both these stories, they are exactly same. Here is Rishi, Shamik Rishi performing the tapasya, and Parikshit Maharaj, the king of the world, has come. Feeling thirsty, he's asking the sage for water, but the sage is not responding because he has conquered hunger and thirst. And here is Agastya Rishi coming to, Indradhanu Maharaj. Agastya Rishi has conquered hunger and thirst, but he is coming to ask, he's coming for some reason to Indradhanu Maharaj. Indradhanu Maharaj is not bothered. The understanding is very simple. When you are transcendent, when you are in a transcendental situation of life, that's great for you. But that doesn't absolve you from certain duties that you need to do in this world. If you are a part of this world, there are some duties that come as a result of being a part of this world. Some small things. So the world is designed for us to help one another. That's the way the world is designed. When someone is seeking help from you, if you are too much absorbed in your own spiritual life, when you're too much absorbed in your own spiritual progress, that you do not care for other people's needs, interests and concerns, then it attracts a curse. Agastya cursed Indradhanu Maharaj and he became an elephant. So here we find Parikshit Maharaj is going to Shamik Rishi and asking him for water. Shamik Rishi is not bothered. And this fellow, the son of Shamik Rishi, Shringa, he gets so upset and he curses Parikshit Maharaj. Shamik Rishi says something very interesting. Shamik Rishi tells his son, "You are a fool. You have no idea what you have done. It is my fault. I should have, taken care of him." So Shamik Rishi never curses Parikshit. He never finds a fault in Parikshit. He never finds a fault in Parikshit in spite of Parikshit putting a snake around his neck. Shamik Rishi finds a fault in himself. This is the sign of advancement. The sign of advancement is not sitting in trance conquering your hunger and thirst. The sign of advancement is when you have conquered your hunger and thirst, but you are still relevant to this world. You are still thinking about the hunger and thirst of other people. You are still trying to satisfy the hunger and thirst of other people. That is when you really have conquered hunger and thirst. Many times, we are lost in this thought process. What is the right way to progress? Should we have some desire? Should we have no desire? The idea is, the problem is not with desire or no desire. The problem is in how you channelize your desires. Like for example, you find many stories of people who do not have children. Like for example, you find the story of Dasharatha Maharaj who doesn't have a son. You find the story of Chitraketu Maharaj who doesn't have a son. You find the story of the Dundukari's father, whatever his name is. That sage, he doesn't have a son. So many people in the past we find who don't have children. So whenever you come across stories in the Bhagavatam, in the Puranas, where a person doesn't have a child, and then you approach, that person approaches a sage. What is the sage's advice? That's very interesting to observe. Most of the sages who are approached by someone with a material desire, like having a child, apparently seems to be material desire. Whenever sages are approached with someone having a material desire, the sages do not blast that person saying, "What nonsense is this? Why are you continuing cycle of birth and death? Why don't you focus on something higher?" No, the sages never advise that. The sages direct the desire towards yajna. They say, if you have a desire, do yajna. So that means, what is the meaning of the word yajna? Yajna means sacrifice, isn't it? So if you have a desire to get something, give up something. Sacrifice something. So the sages are dovetailing your desire towards Krishna. Dovetailing your desire by bringing in the element of spirituality into it. Bringing in the element of yajna into it. And therefore, when we find that instead of giving a lecture on nishkam karma, you need to find the way in which that desire can be directed for a greater welfare. So you find that Vashishta tells Dasharath, do yajna. Chitrakuta Maharaj has this desire. Narada Muni directs him towards something higher. You know, so every person who has any kind of desires, Dhruva Maharaj approaches, you know, Narada with great desire. Narada directs him towards doing some yajna, doing some sacrifice, basically. So in life, our actions are usually beneficial for us, our family and our friends. But yajna means welfare of larger society. And therefore, the guru always encourages his disciple not for nishkam karma, but yajna karma. So what is the meaning of yajna karma? Yajna karma simply means that whatever desire you have, direct it towards yajna. Direct it towards some sacrifice for the pleasure of the Lord. So if there is desire, you can take either an auspicious way of fulfilling the desire or an inauspicious way of fulfilling the desire. The yajna performed by these great personalities are pure and auspicious. So underlying the yajna is a kaam, is a desire. But because that desire is fulfilled in an auspicious way, that desire doesn't become inauspicious. So kama is not inauspicious if it is directed towards yajna. But you'll find in the scriptures there are many people who do yajna for an inauspicious reason. Like say for example in Mahabharata, you find Drupad Maharaj does a yajna. But why does the yajna? He does the yajna to have a son who will kill his enemy. So this is the difference between having the right mindset and having the wrong mindset. So in the scriptures, you'll find people who are encouraged to give. But when you give happily, and when you give voluntarily, you get the benefit of giving. But when you give without joy, and when you give forcefully, you don't get the benefit of giving. Like there was one old man who got into a train, and there was no place to sit in the train. And a few stations later, so the old man was standing. A few stations later, one young man got up, and he told the old man, please come and take this seat. The old man told him, if it's your seat, why don't you take it with you? So this young man got bewildered. So what he meant to say was that, what you can't, you know, you're giving what you can't take away anyways. Isn't it? So there's no point in showing off that I'm giving. So that type of giving has no meaning at all. Isn't it? So there are many people who when they have no use of something, they give it. Like our temple typically gets a lot of donations, you know, of stuff that people don't want to use at home anymore. They'll give a chair or they'll give some fan. Or they'll give some vehicle, 15 years over, you can't use it anymore on the road, give it to temple, you know. So they feel they're giving, basically. So there is no point in such giving. And therefore, we need to do what is known as meaningful giving. So meaningful giving is when it is done voluntarily, happily, it is done with the right consciousness, and it is done keeping in mind the benefit of the person you're giving it to. Not your own benefit, basically. So therefore, we find dana or the process of giving has its own interesting cycle, or rather an interesting series of steps to give. First, you give away the object. Suppose you give something to someone. You give the object away first. And then you separate your attachment from that object. That means you give, and then you, the second step is that you give away mamata for that object. There are many people that give, and then they keep telling everybody, see, this is mine. I gave him. Yeah. So that means you have given the object, but your attachment to that object continues. Isn't it? That continues for like years together sometimes. I remember, you know, when I was very small, we had a Fiat car. Olden times in the 80s and 90s, it used to be this Fiat Premier Padmini, you know. And we used that car for like 10, 12 years, you know. I mean, I learned driving in that car. And then after the car was literally useless, you know. I mean, I learned driving in the car, had a gear like this. And interestingly, the gear used to come out also. So we used to keep it on the side and drive. And whenever we change gear, we would put it first and then change, you know. It was so old. And while driving on the highway, the bonnet would open up and all, you know. So it was so old, you know. It was pathetically old. And finally, we had no way to use it. We gave it away. But I still remember, I was living in a small city, you know. And I still remember that car used to roam around in that city. And whenever I used to see that car, I used to feel, "Array, this is mine only," you know. So you're giving the object away, but the mamata, that it is mine, has not been given away. So that mamata we carry still, basically. So the second step of the process of giving is give that mamata away. Give the thought that it is mine, you know, that attachment that it is mine away. And the third step in giving is to give up the pride that I give. That's the third step in giving, basically. So first you give the object, and then you sacrifice the mamata, and then you sacrifice the ahamta that I gave, basically. And that is when charity becomes meaningful to society. That is when charity becomes, you know, realistic, and it becomes useful to society. So when we really think from the point of view of bhoga, so like what we are seeing in this particular story, that this whole story is connected with hunger. One person is hungry and the other person is not satisfying his hunger. That's what this story is all about, right? So bhoga means I want to enjoy for myself. But when we offer to God and then we eat, it becomes prasad. So when we offer to God and then we eat, it's not bhoga anymore, but it is prasad. So the same thing. So basically, the idea here is that we first offer to God and then distribute to everybody else. And if anything is left, we eat. The same way we should deal with subtler aspects of life, like for example, praise. So if somebody praises you, first we offer it to God. And then we show gratitude to everybody else associated, you know, who have helped us achieve something. And then if at all anything is left, then we keep it for ourselves. But most people, they are so hungry for praise, they keep everything for themselves only. They don't want to share with others. So that's why hunger is considered so bad in the scriptures. So technically, hunger is not just physical hunger. That is why if you study the scriptures, there are many, many, many stories of people who are hungry in the scriptures. All through the scriptures, you study the Bhagavatam, you study Ramayana, you study Mahabharata, you study any of the Puranas, you will find a lot of hungry people in this world. Here, Shamik Rishi and Parikshit Maharaj, all problem with hunger. Bhagavatam begins with problem with hunger. So, why do you find so many discussions of hungry and thirsty people in the scriptures? The scriptures are telling us, the world is filled with hunger and thirst. The idea is, That's what animalistic life is all about. Hunger, thirst. All animals in this world, you know, they are like just focused on this, right? Hunger and thirst. Hunger, thirst. How to mitigate. But the sages have conquered and overcome hunger and thirst. Imagine. The very thing that is driving the world. Now imagine if you come to a situation where you don't feel hungry and thirsty, not in an unhealthy way, but in a healthy way. You just don't feel hungry and thirsty. Will there be any problems in this world? All problems in this world are connected with hunger and thirst only. But look at the sages. The sages have found a formula to conquer hunger and thirst. How? By going deeper. By going into the Atma level. At the level of the Atma, the nourishment comes from the Paramatma. It comes from the spiritual understanding that we have. And therefore, the scriptures inspire us to go on to a path which is very different from the path that the world offers us. Parikshit Maharaj, at this point in time, he was so hungry and so thirsty. But after he got this curse by Sringi, after he got this curse, then he sat with Shukadev Goswami for 7 days and 7 nights. Did he eat and drink? Interesting. He never ate and drank. He didn't feel like eating and drinking. How come the very person who is so thirsty in the beginning that he put a snake around the sage eventually becomes so thirstless and so hungerless that he doesn't eat and drink for 7 days and 7 nights and is still not agitated? That is what spirituality leads you towards, basically. So, spirituality inspires you. So at this point when Parikshit was hungry and thirsty, who was he? He was the king of the world. Being the king of the world, he feels, I deserve everything. But when he gave up that post of being the king of the world, and he walked into the forest to sit with Shukadeva Goswami, what is he? He is not a king of the world. Who is he? He is a person who has lost. What has he lost? He has lost everything. He has lost his kingdom. He has lost his... He is going to lose his life. He has lost everything, basically. When Parikshit reached a state of losing, that is when he gains victory over hunger and thirst. So the Srimad Bhagavatam gives a lot of weightage to losing. Losing is a very important word in bhakti. In the material world, losing is not a very important word. In fact, it's considered a bad word, isn't it? So if somebody loses, that person is considered to be like a loser. But in the scriptures, winning makes us believe that we are fully capable and I don't need God. When we win in the game of life, we think that I am fully capable, I don't need God. Without losing, we can't get rid of this belief. When Parikshit Maharaj loses, suddenly he starts realizing that I am not capable of winning all battles of life on my own. I need help. So, there is no scarcity of those who become proud on winning or those that become dejected on losing. The world is full of people who are proud of winning or they become dejected on losing. Pride goes to the head, failure goes to the heart. A proud person becomes, you know, thinks that I can, you know, do anything. And a dejected person, a loser, thinks that I'm depressed, isn't it? Both are bad. So, the idea that the scriptures teach us is that winning is God's prasad. It's God's gift for us. And losing is God's invitation from Him. Parikshit Maharaj, as long as he was winning, he was thinking, God is kind on me, giving me so many gifts of victory. But when he lost, he realized, God is inviting me. So Parikshit considered losing as an invitation by God. So if a friend sends you a gift, You'll be happy, isn't it? Suppose a friend sends you an Apple Watch. You'll be extremely happy, isn't it? But if a friend sends you an invitation, please come. I want to meet you. That's more happy, ideally, at least, you know. That should ideally give you more happiness, more joy, you know. So when God sends a victory to a living entity, it brings joy. We should thank Him for sending victory. It's like God sending you a gift. But when you experience loss, we should consider it as an invitation by God. God is calling me, you know. So therefore, we find in the scriptures, the losers attain God faster. So if you look at, study any of our scriptures, you know, like say for example, Sugriv got Ram faster than Vali got Ram. Vali eventually got Ram, but Sugriv got Ram first, you know. So anyone who apparently is a loser, he gets God first. And then eventually, the one who is a winner gets God. So here we find Parikshit Maharaj, the feeling of being capable connects us to pride. And the feeling of being incapable connects us to God. When Parikshit felt capable, he felt very proud. And he put the snake around his neck. But when Parikshit felt incapable, he suddenly got access to something much, much higher. He got access to Srimad Bhagavatam. And therefore, even if we are losers or incapable, if we connect our incapacity with God and take shelter of a saint to recognize God and connect with God, that saint ensures that we attain God. And when God enters into our life, He deletes all our faults. So Parikshit Maharaj had many faults in him. But the moment he became a loser, the moment he realized I'm incapable, he connected to the saint. And that saint, Shukadeva Goswami, connected him with God. And God came into Parikshit's life and eliminated all the faults that Parikshit had and gave him an experience that was so much higher. This story of Srimad Bhagavatam is a very interesting story because the story revolves around snakes. The story began 3 generations before with Arjun. Arjun, he burnt the Khandava forest. And while burning the Khandava forest, he burnt so many of the relatives and friends of Takshak, the snake. Takshak decided to take revenge on Arjun. And Takshak entered into the Nagastra of Karna. But somehow Krishna was there in Arjun's life. He saved Arjun from the Nagastra. And then Takshak couldn't do anything to Arjun. But the desire to destroy Arjun was so strong in Takshak. He decided, I will destroy anybody who is in Arjun's lineage. Obviously, before Takshak could do anything, Abhimanyu died. So now, next generation also is gone, you know. And the Takshak decided, I will destroy the generation after Abhimanyu, which is Parikshit Maharaj. So Parikshit, now how did Takshak destroy Parikshit? He destroyed Parikshit in 2 ways. First, he destroyed by allowing the dead snake to remain somewhere in the vicinity of Parikshit Maharaj. Have you ever wondered, Shamik Rishi is doing meditation over there. Have you ever wondered how did the dead snake come there? Randomly dead snake lying over there. Nothing is random. You know, there is nothing called coincidence in the scriptures. Everything is a plan of the Lord and everything is plan of destiny. That dead snake lying there is also an act of destiny that gave Takshak an opportunity to come back into Parikshit's life and destroy him. So that very snake that Arjun, you know, troubled and harmed over there, one of those snakes remained over there as a dead snake. And Parikshit put that dead snake around Shamik Rishi's neck. And then Sringi, the son of Shamik Rishi, he could have cursed Parikshit with any curse, isn't it? How many curses are there in this world? I mean, if you want to do bad to somebody, there are so many ways to do bad to someone, right? But of all the curses, Sringi, what curse he gave? He gave the curse that a snake bird will come and bite him. Again, gave opportunity, you know, for the snake bird to come. And eventually, Takshak comes and bites Parikshit Maharaj. And Parikshit Maharaj, he doesn't care. He's already beyond the body. He goes back to the spiritual world. And then, There was a sage named, so Takshak gets his revenge, right? There's a sage named Uttanka. Now Uttanka has a problem with Takshak. Because once, you know, Uttanka was getting some earrings back for his guru's wife, and this Takshak caused him trouble. So from that time, Uttanka was thinking, I'll take revenge on this guy. And he got the idea of taking revenge by going and instigating Parikshit's son Janmajay. See, your father got killed by this snake. You should take revenge from all snakes. So Uttanka was not interested in helping Janmajay, but rather he was interested in getting his own revenge through Janmajay. And then Uttanka inspired Janmajay to do the snake sacrifice. So Janmajay did the snake sacrifice. Thousands and thousands of snakes came. And all of them were dying into the fire. And Takshak also was being dragged into the fire. At that time, another sage comes, whose name is Astika. And this sage comes and tells Parikshit Maharaj, tells Janmajay, forgive. There is no end to this cycle. This will go on and on and on. Just let go. And Janmajay somehow fortunately hears the words of Astika and he gives up the desire to destroy the snakes. And the moment Janmajay gives up the desire to destroy the snakes, he becomes peaceful. Takshak, you know, gets freed from that whole thing. The cycle gets completed. And with forgiveness, the whole story ends. So Parikshit Maharaj, the interesting thing is, snake is poisonous. But what is the real poison? The real poison is not the snake poison. The real poison is hatred that you carry in your heart. That's the real poison. The real nectar is the ability to forgive. So Parikshit Maharaj, when he heard, so Shamik Rishi, as soon as Parikshit put the snake on his head and he went away, Shamik Rishi didn't carry that hatred in his heart. He forgave immediately. He said, it's okay. I mean, I only made a mistake. I didn't feed him water. So he just left it. Shringi carried the hatred in his heart. Shringi was not able to forgive. But when Shringi cursed Parikshit, Parikshit immediately forgave. Because he was going into the mood of the sages, right? Because he already experienced losing. And he realized that I'm incapable. And the moment he realized he's incapable, he connected to the saint. And the saint connected him towards God. And the moment you get on the path of God, forgiveness becomes a part of your life. And Janmajay, he was caught in the cycle again of, you know, hatred. Because Uttanka instigated it. But Astika came and helped him forgive. So essentially, to summarize all of it, something very simple. Hunger is something that is a part of all of our lives. And that hunger makes us do mad things. To overcome hunger, we need to learn to develop a saintly demeanor in our life. And a person who has a saintly demeanor, he doesn't hold hatred in his heart. He doesn't hold hunger in his heart. He doesn't hold these, you know, petty things in his heart. But rather, he holds a much higher purpose in his heart. And because of that, the sages are able to overcome hunger easily. They're able to overcome thirst easily. They're able to overcome hatred easily. They're able to overcome malice easily. And in that mood, the sages are able to embrace forgiveness. They're able to embrace the higher truths of life. And that makes them so much free from all these shortcomings, hunger and thirst. What is real hunger? The real hunger is not the hunger for food and water. The real hunger and thirst is the hunger for recognition, the hunger for appreciation, the hunger for praise, the hunger for, you know, greatness, the hunger for taking from others. And what is really overcoming hunger and thirst? The real overcoming hunger and thirst is not wanting, not aspiring for praise, not aspiring for, greatness, not aspiring for, wealth, or not aspiring for any of those things. The moment you stop aspiring for any of those things, hunger and thirst have no ability to control you. But rather, you can control them. Thank you very much. Grantra Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.